Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Well, I think the market is the market, and you know, our growers are aware of that. I think that inflation is certainly something that is a part of all of society right now.
Tim Laws, President and CEO, National Sorghum Producers.
I think it is, again, just to reiterate what's been talked about, I think it is something that as we start talking about the next farm bill, I think it is something that we have to talk about and look at. And I think, you know, that comes into a resource discussion. And, you know, those are not easy issues and not easy topics. But I think as we look at the safety net, it is important from this inflation discussion to make sure that from a grower standpoint, we have a safety net going forward.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We just echo the importance of crop insurance overall. We worked through multiple farm bills in the past for some formulas to change the price election component for sorghum and allow that to track markets and change over time. And happy to say that that's working and is something that's been very good for our industry.
Tim Lust is CEO for the National Sorghum Producers, part of a CEO roundtable on the next farm bill held recently at Commodity Classic.
I think we also, you know, in this discussion, that you have to separate crop insurance out, and then you have to separate, as you mentioned, some of this disaster challenges. And so certainly for our membership, the WIP Plus for 20 and 21 is something that, you know, we're looking to get delivered to the country. Our growers need that, and so continue to have those discussions with USDA and continue to also evaluate that from a policy standpoint as far as future legislation. Don't have any positions from a sorghum industry standpoint. We're just doing the analysis really to say, what does this look like? What might be the right fit or how might that work together in the future?
John Doggett is CEO for the National Corn Growers Association.
You know, if we want to bring the next generation of farmers to the farm, to be able, and those folks will better be able to use the technology that Kurt's folks are producing, they can do that, but they have to have risk management tools because they're going to be in a different position than that farmer who's 60 years old who has, you know, the capital resources to go ahead and handle a weather event. So crop insurance is really, really vital to younger growers, and we need more fresh blood back at the farm. And so those risk management tools are really, really important, not just to keep the economic viability going on the farm, but really to continue to hold on to our rural communities and our rural values. But you got to have young people to do that.
Chandler Gould is CEO of the National Association of Wheat Growers, talks about challenges to getting a farm bill.
What farm bill was that? The 2012-13-14 farm bill that we worked on, where we were having good commodity prices, and I couldn't get a grower to call their congressman to save my life to help us get that farm bill passed. But I think the other thing that this uptick in prices that we were already seeing, especially for wheat and corn, before the Russia and Ukraine conflict, we were seeing increase in cost of production, that the farm bill has got to be able to protect against that increased cost of production. So, yes, I'm talking specifically about PLC and reference prices have got to come more in line with what our true cost of production is. Otherwise, it's not truly a safety net.
Steve Sinski is CEO for the American Soybean Association.
Say that traditionally the farm bill has been a safety net, and the safety net should be there. And obviously you have to take into account when you set reference prices for commodities, you know, what should those be to have that kind of safety net for producers? And the cost of producing a commodity may be one component of that. And so that, I think, has always factored into how Congress has set those. It's not necessarily only based on cost of production, but it's one of the factors that Congress has always traditionally considered in setting those reference prices or target prices previously.
That's Steve Sinski with the American Soybean Association. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
When you look at the corn futures complex from the leads into the deferreds, we have the May contract right now in the lead, and March has gone off the board. May contract, again, trading at 754.5 yesterday, as we talked about. D's trading at about 645, and you've got monthly declines, again, i.e. an inverted market.
Dr. Dan O'Brien's a Kansas State grain marketing economist, talking about those inverted markets.
During 2022 on these contracts, from May to July, about 18 cents a month inversion. From July to September, about 26 cents a month. And even from September to D's at about 7.5 cents a month. But what I find interesting is that you go beyond D's and look at that next year, it looks like the market is trying to come into some settled structure. There's actually a slight positive carry. It's almost comical in that March is at 645 and a quarter yesterday, May at 645 and a half. And July, pretty similar, just down a cent or so. Anyway, it seems like we're trying to move beyond the issues of this year and trying to look out into that next year and are anticipating a more stable market situation. And then, of course, once you get from July at 643 and three quarters down to into September at 590, you've dropped 40 cents, looking at more of a normal harvest situation. So that's of interest there. The market that was really causing the fireworks, though, is the wheat market. When you look at that, we still have, I think that the position of the futures tell the story of the expectations of how the market thinks will unwind, what the market is voting right now in terms of prices, how it thinks will unwind this current supply-demand situation that we're in. So again, May closed yesterday 1092 and a quarter, then July 1083, September 1058, D's 2022 1033. So you're losing about 4 to about 12 cents per bushel per month on down through that marketing year. But then it's kind of opposite of corn. Then you're heading off into March of 23, May of 23, July, particularly going March to May, you're dropping 31 cents a month. From May to July, you're dropping 62 cents a month per month and moving down a little bit then into September. So it seems that the market's anticipating that our current troubles will resolve themselves out there into 2023, that we'll plant a crop, that we'll be able to harvest it, and they're anticipating a fall off into that harvest of 2023, all that much more than what they're even looking at now for this year. I should add in soybeans too while we're on this. Again, it's interesting to see from May to July, a drop off about 10 cents per month, but then you go from July to August, 43 cents. From August to September, 81 cents. 81 cents in 1 month. And then from September to November, about 26, 27 cents. So it seems that the grain markets, through their futures bids, are anticipating that by the time the U.S. crop comes in, they're indicating that they think prices will fall off pretty sharply. There's still, like November is still 1469 as on yesterday's close. But in terms of the relative position, they're looking at prices falling lower off into harvest. We get a new crop, a good harvest coming in the United States, and that would affect the market in a downward manner. Still tremendous price bids, and we see that actually often in new crop bids too. So still high prices, but these patterns are showing, I think, what the expectations of the market are as we try to unwind things the next 12, 18 months.
That's Dan O'Brien, Kansas State grain marketing economist on inverted markets. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Expected progeny differences, or EPDs, are an estimate of the breeding value of an animal for a particular trait.
Oklahoma State University Extension Beef Cattle Breeding Specialist, Dr. Mark Johnson.
The convenient thing about EPDs is that they are reported in the units that that particular trait gets measured in. These things are helpful to us to compare to other animals in that registry or in that same breed to think about their genetic potential as a parent. So give a couple of examples. Let's say we're comparing two bulls in their weaning weight EPDs, and we see a bull that's at 61 versus a bull that's at 50. What that is telling us, that 11-pound difference, is if we mate those two bulls to an equal set of cows, we're going to see about 11-pound heavier calves at weaning in that next calf crop. If we look at a heifer pregnancy EPD, for example, these are reported in percentage units indicating the likelihood that a bull's daughters actually get bred in that first calving season. So if we compare two bulls, say one is a 15 and one is a 9, that means the bull at a 15 is advantaging 6 percentage points. If we let them sire a set of daughters, the bull at 15, his daughters are 6% more likely to get bred in that first breeding season that we expose them to bulls. So EPDs are always reported in the units that we typically report a trade in, and we use them for comparison's sake to think about what we should see in that calf crop or that set of offspring that they actually sire.
Now that we know what an EPD is, what's a dollar value EPD?
Dollar values are something that's really came on the scene in the last 20 years. And in a dollar value, we're taking a group of traits that we know impact a particular, they impact the value at a particular marketing endpoint, or maybe they're all traits that impact a particular breeding goal. So we put an economic weighting on all those things, and we take several EPDs and distill them down to a dollar value that, again, is predicting differences in the value of offspring. Let's take a look at one of these as an example, a dollar beef that gets reported by the American Angus Association. This value actually puts an economic weighting on dry matter intake, yearling weight, carcass weight, fat thickness, ribeye area, and marbling score, and that economic weighting gets distilled down to a dollar value. So if we compare two bulls, let's say one's got a dollar B of 225, one's got a dollar B of 200. The 25-pound difference indicates the additional value we should see in his offspring if we are going to market those as fed cattle on a carcass value basis. So dollar values permit us to select for several things that we know are economically important relative to a specific marketing endpoint or breeding goal.
What does accuracy tell us?
An accuracy is typically something we see abbreviated as ACC, reported along with every EPD that actually gets reported. Accuracies tell us what the reliability is we should place in the EPD, but another way of thinking about them is basically that they range from 0 to 1, and they indicate the amount of information that's been taken into account in generating that particular EPD. So an accuracy value that gets closer to 1 means that we have a lot of ancestors, pedigree relatives, offspring, and potentially DNA data taken into account to get that value up closer to a 1. And typically younger animals, when they're first born, where their EPDs are just an average of their parents, are going to be lower in accuracy value, and that more information we collect on progeny or families or DNA bumps that value up higher.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I'm also proud that President Biden and Secretary Vilsack have laid out a clear vision for agriculture and rural America.
Addressing members of the Ag Committee, where she once was a member, so she tore us small, now under Secretary for Rural Development.
Building back better from COVID-19, expanding options for more and better markets for farmers and ranchers, helping us all survive extreme weather and build resiliency through climate smart tools, and reaching people in places that have been historically underserved, advancing racial justice, equity, and opportunity. Because rural America has incredible potential, but it cannot be fully realized without reliable infrastructure. That looks like broadband, but it also looks like hospitals, schools, community centers, water and wastewater services, housing, sustainable energy, all of which are critical for quality of life, as well as for growth and resiliency. Your work as representatives means you're clear-eyed on the challenges that we'll face in turning these investments into infrastructure on the ground. I know I'm in a rural community when I'm in a room full of people who care deeply about their home, but not one of them is a grant writer, which means that we're going to have to take a hard look at how we deliver our programs equitably. We're going to have to recognize that we haven't always done a good job giving people a fair chance of success, and it means we're going to be working hard to reduce barriers into the future.
But Steve Sinski, CEO of the American Soybean Association, says be very careful.
The point that you're raising is a fair one about making sure that as the EPA and our other government agencies develop regulations, that they don't arbitrarily pick winners, that you actually do have to do the science. I mean, one of the struggles, and again, you know, we should all be agnostic, you know, I mean, in terms of what is the science behind, you know, liquid-fueled vehicles versus electric vehicles, let's go ahead and do the science. And right now, many times, it's the cost and the emissions from the mining and the chemicals that are used to produce the batteries that are going to be in those electric vehicles. That's not calculated as a cost, whereas our total life cycle analysis of producing our crops, processing our crops, and turning them into biofuels is counted. That if you're going to do a life cycle analysis, let's do a true life cycle analysis on both sides, on all the technologies, and then let's compare them.
When it comes to wildfires, though, it picks its own winners and losers. Andy Holloway is a Hemphill County, Texas extension agent. Talks about the devastating wildfires in Central Texas.
I have contact information for these people I've mentioned. If somebody in your area and your listening audience wants to send hay, I can provide you, or they can call our office and I can get them the contact information as to who to contact, where to send their hay donations. They can get on Facebook. And of course, they can look up Eastland County AgriLife Extension and go and see what the resources that they're putting out. But if they do want to work with us, if you do have people in your listening audience that want to participate with our local ranchers to buy these cubes and other things we're going to do, they can call our office in Canadian, Texas at 806-323-9114. We're through our AgriLife Extension Ag Committee. We're handling these funds, and I can just promise that every nickel will go towards the benefit of these people that we're trying to help.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Drought is the predominant thing that we hear and hear and that we see around the state, as well as we are now traveling and getting a lot of our own field work done in our trials all over the state. So we are seeing that the crop is suffering from drought stress anywhere from like locations that we have in central Kansas, like Hutchinson and Belleville and Solomon, all the way to locations where we have in western Kansas, like Leawoody and Garden City.
That's Kansas State wheat production specialist Romolo Lolato, who's talking about the drought across Kansas.
So that has been the predominant talk. Whenever we talk of the crop conditions as well, I think it's important for us to mention that the stage of development is quite variable around the state for a few main reasons, right? If we think of western Kansas, there were a few precipitation events in September, and some growers took advantage of that, and they planted quite early to take advantage of that precipitation event. It grew quite a bit. You know, there were quite a few fields out in western Kansas with what we call very big wheat that uses more moisture as well. So it's kind of like we have that effect of the moisture stress being even harsher on some of those early planted crops. More in central Kansas here, typically the crop planted after wheat was planted on time. Then we have a small crop that got planted after soybeans and didn't have a chance to get much tillering during the fall, mostly because, again, of dry conditions. So conditions during the fall and winter were quite dry. So except for that crop that got planted pretty early and took advantage of that, a lot of the crop was actually kind of like slow and behind in terms of tillering potential. Now, it's interesting that we had a couple of very cold spells during the winter, right? And that seemed to hit the crop differently as well, depending on how far along the crop was or how big the crop was. In our own trials near Hutchinson, the crop that was planted early, and by early I mean around September 20th, with the intent of dual purpose that we're going to talk here in a minute, it got burned back really bad in terms of that cold spell. So it lost a lot of leaf area, a lot of vegetation. I don't think it's actually hurting in terms of losing stand, but it did lose a considerable amount of leaf area, whereas the smaller crop that was just like two or three tillers, it seemed to have taken that spell better. Now, important to notice that we're not talking about this small crop that has no tillers, right? We're talking about still a crop that had two or three tillers going into the winter, and it took it pretty well. So those are some of the observations that we have going on around the state in terms of crop conditions. So again, drought being the predominant factor across the state, and this difference in crop development depending on planting time and moisture conditions at planting also impacting not only the status of the crop now, but its response to the couple of cold spells that we have had over the winter.
Kansas is the top wheat-producing state in the nation. So how much rain is needed at this point to save the crop?
We need about at least a good 4 inches or so before the wheat crop starts producing some grain, right? Because that's the amount of water that is simply lost to the atmosphere through evaporation or percolation down the profile. So at least those 4 inches plus for the wheat crop to start producing grain. Now, how much is the available water? It depends on a number of factors. The crop can be really efficient in using the water that it gets if that water is timely. There are some very high efficient there in terms of how much grain can be produced per unit of water that the crop receives. So, but it needs to be timely, right? And definitely we will need that moisture now to put whatever fertilizer has been put out in the field into the root zone and to allow the crop to continue tillering for any potential that it still has during the spring. But especially because from now on, between the start of the stem elongation where we are now until that heading stage is the steepest curve in terms of water used by the crop.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
It's called Anatomy of a Price Spike. And no, we're not talking about 2010, 2011, where, you know, we jumped from roughly 80 cents a pound Labor Day weekend up to, you know, over $2 a pound in May of 2011.
Gerald Nieper is president of TrueCut, headquartered in Bakersfield, California.
Certainly, we've had a nice run here over the last several months. You know, April 1st, 2020, contract low 48.35. February 1, 2022, contract high of 129.37.
He talks about the reasons for this run-up in prices.
Well, let's start with May 1st, 2019. The December 2019 contract was trading around, you know, 75 cents a pound, and it started drifting lower as we moved into the April-May, you know, time period. You know, what was going on at that time period? Well, U.S. and world economy started slowing. You know, in fact, the Fed was getting browbeat to do something about the interest rate. So the Fed reduced the Fed funds rates, you know, by 75 basis points, really between July of 2019 and October 2019. Also during that time period, you know, from May to December, you know, USDA was reducing production. They were reducing consumption and ending stocks were coming down a little bit. Now the deficit increased mainly because the production wasn't coming down quickly as the production estimate or the consumption estimates. Between May of 19 and December of 19, world production was cut 4.3 million bales and consumption by 5.7 million. U.S. crop was cut 1.8 million. Pakistan was cut 1.8 million. Others, 1.6. The only countries out there that were doing anything on the plus side in a meaningful way were India and Brazil, and they were up 1.5 million bales.
What was another catalyst to this market fire?
We can move into the January-February time period, Jan-Feb-March, and you got the March contract there. You know, prices started going higher. You know, it looked like things were improving. Friday, January 10th, USDA cut world production again on the 2019-20 crop year by 600,000 bales. World ending stocks were cut by 700,000. U.S. ending stocks were down a full million bales from the original May 2019 contract. And March on that day was up 62 points to settle at 71.31. But also on that same day, you know, USDA noted that the novel coronavirus outbreak and potential ramifications have certainly, you know, raised a red flag in terms of consumption anywhere around the world, but particularly in China, you know, more than offsetting the potential positive impacts from the U.S.-China trade truce. Now, this trade truce, of course, it wasn't signed until January 15th, 2020, but it was pretty much negotiated in the middle of December, and people were aware of it. But this trade truce, you know, committed China to buying a certain number of dollars of over and above a 2017 baseline. For agriculture, that meant an additional $12.5 billion in year one, which is 2020, and an additional $19.5 billion over year two, over the baseline of $24.1 billion. And, you know, that seemed to get everybody kind of excited. But you see kind of a drifting down in prices. January 31, you know, U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services, you know, announced that the public health emergency and announced implementation of new travel policies to be effective on 5 p.m. on February 2nd. you know, this announcement broke the back of the March 2020 contract. It never saw another trade over 70 cents a pound.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The Agriculture Department continues to work on making families more food secure, having enough food. But now Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says his department is increasing its efforts in
creating an America that is also nutritionally secure.
Vilsack telling an audience at Columbia University Teachers College in New York City that COVID has been a wake-up call on this because two-thirds of the COVID hospitalizations have been people with diet-related conditions such as diabetes and obesity. Vilsack said his entire department is going to be working on improving nutrition using what he called four strategic pillars.
Support for nutrition throughout all stages of life. Connecting all Americans to healthy, safe, and affordable food sources. Developing and translating and enacting and enabling nutrition science through partnerships to get to ordinary individuals and prioritizing equity.
He said those pillars or guidelines will apply to everything USDA does in the field of food and nutrition assistance and education. Gary Crawford, Washington.